This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents Descent into Darkness, Pearl Harbor, 1941, a Navy diver's memoir. Written by Edward C. Raymer. Narrated by Peter Johnson. To Marilyn, a woman of lasting beauty, a confidant and supporter, a wise counselor and critic, a loving mother, a perfect wife. Prologue. Pearl Harbor, Territory of Hawaii. In solemn stillness, the USS Arizona lay at peace. Jarred by massive explosions and gutted by fire, the battleship had slipped beneath the waves of Pearl Harbor on 7 December 1941. Only the mast and part of her superstructure remained visible. But she was not abandoned, for she served as an underwater tomb for more than 1,000 American sailors and Marines. On 12 January 1942, the once great battleship was boarded again, this time by me, a Navy salvage diver. Our diving barge tied up to the starboard side of the Arizona. I looked at the pitiful wreckage and wondered if we could ever raise her. As senior petty officer and leader of our diving crew, I decided to make the first dive. My dive that day would be the first salvage dive inside the sunken hull. An external survey revealed what appeared to be a hole below the mud line on the after port side, presumably made by an unexploded torpedo or bomb. My mission: find the missile and attach a lock on the propeller to prevent it from arming itself and exploding. The submarine base assigned a chief torpedo man to provide technical assistance if we needed help to disarm the torpedo. No salvage work could begin until the missile was rendered safe. This is a simple task for a trained diver. But as it turned out, there was nothing simple about it. It was standard procedure before each dive for the diver and the telephone talker to lay out the route the diver expected to follow within the ship. The ship's plan was used as a road map to direct the diver from the entry point in the ship to his ultimate destination. The plan was never memorized by the diver, since he had too many other things to occupy his mind as he moved through the ship. Rather, the diver familiarized himself with the general layout of the route, while the telephone talker used the details of the plan to direct the diver on his path. The ship's plan showed the frame numbers and the location of doors, fire hydrants, blower motors, and so on for each deck. Explosions and fires had destroyed many of these signposts, which forced us to take numerous detours, so the plans were invaluable for us to use as a starting point. We determined that the external hole below the mud line placed the missile in the vicinity of the general workshop located on the third deck level. There was no visible damage to the main deck above that area, so we were confident the missile had not exploded. Now that I had my route fixed in my mind, I was ready to start my dive. I pulled on my rubberized diving suit and shoved my feet into the 36-pound lead-soled shoes. Then my tenders bolted the metal breastplate to my suit. I stood and thrust my arms through the shoulder straps of the 84-pound lead-weighted belt. Then, with some difficulty, I straightened to my full height of 6 feet. The diving suit was cumbersome above water. I gestured toward the heavy copper helmet. My tenders placed it on my shoulders and secured it to the breastplate with a twisting motion. Now my vision was limited to what I could see through the small glass ports in the helmet. With exaggerated deliberation, I climbed down the wooden ladder and entered the oil-covered water. My helmet was barely awash as I walked aft on the battleship's main deck, skirting wreckage. The dense floating mass of oil blotted out all daylight. I was submerged in total blackness. Only a line of air bubbles that popped to the surface marked my path for topside observers as I traveled the 35 feet to the Arizona's entrance. Grunting with exertion, I tried to open the large hatch. "Topside, this damn hatch is stuck," I said into my helmet phone. "The gasket probably melted from the heat of the fires. I'm going forward to the access trunk hatch and use that opening." I slowly groped my way across the littered deck to the hatch. I forced the trunk hatch open and descended into the darkness below. This trunk on the Arizona was a square shaft that extended uninterrupted from the main deck to the third deck. I extended my right hand to guide myself down through the trunk. By following the shaft straight down, my hand was pointed in the direction necessary to follow the working plan. As I landed on the third deck level, I knew by the position of my extended arm that I was headed for the starboard side of the ship. "Topside, I'm on the third deck. Give me 300 feet of slack." Slack coming down, take it in, came the response. I pulled down my coupled lifeline and air hose, coiling them at my feet. My lifeline contained a quarter-inch diameter wire built to withstand a strain of 3,000 pounds. Telephone wires were wrapped around it and encased in rubber. There was a watertight telephone connection attached to the rear of the diving helmet. Telephone wires ran inside the helmet to the transmitter receiver located in the top of the helmet. The other end of the telephone wires and lifeline connection were attached to the telephonic transmitter receiver box on the diving barge. The diver could transmit and receive messages. The telephone talker could receive the diver's messages continuously. When the talker wanted to communicate with the diver, he depressed a transmitter key and sent his message. The diver could not transmit until the key was released. At 3-foot intervals, the air hose was tied to the lifeline with waterproof twine, creating small loops in the air hose so that any strain in lifting and lowering the diver remained on the lifeline. When I received the slack in my lines, I straightened up to get my bearings. I moved cautiously, feeling my way with ungloved hands toward the starboard bulkhead in the compartment, which was my starting point. What I would find, I had no inkling. Eventually, it would severely draw on every ounce of courage I possessed. As I looked up, I saw a light that glowed dimly, flickered, and disappeared. It must have been phosphorescence in the water, I thought, as the blackness enveloped me once again. I shrugged as I thought, I would settle for just enough light to be able to see the end of my nose. Suddenly, I felt that something was wrong. I tried to suppress the strange feeling that I was not alone. I reached out to feel my way and touched what seemed to be a large inflated bag floating on the overhead. As I pushed it away, my bare hand plunged through what felt like a mass of rotted sponge. I realized with horror that the bag was a body without a head. Gritting my teeth, I shoved the corpse as hard as I could. As it drifted away, its fleshless fingers raked across my rubberized suit, almost as if the dead sailor were reaching out to me in a silent cry for help. I fought to choke down the bile that rose in my throat. That bloated torso had once contained viscera, muscle, and firm tissue. It had been a man. I could hear the quickening thump of my pulse. For the first time, I felt confined in the suffocating darkness and had to suppress the desire to escape. "Breathe slowly, breathe deeply," I commanded myself. "I must stay calm, professional, detached." The dangers from falling wreckage, holes in the deck, and knife-sharp jagged edges were real, formidable hazards. I must not succumb to terror over something that could not harm me. I concentrated on finding the first road sign before starting toward the shop. "Topside, I'm facing the bulkhead and my left hand is on the fire hydrant." Moon's voice answered. "Move to your left about 10 feet and reach your hand up to the overhead and you should feel a large blower motor. Continue 6 feet beyond and you will feel a watertight door in the after bulkhead of the workshop." I did as instructed and felt my way through the darkness toward the door to the machine shop, accompanied only by the sound of the air hissing into my helmet from the air hose trailing behind me. At the shop doorway, I hesitated and drew my lifeline toward me. I'm inside the shop doorway. There was that feeling again. "Turn and face the after bulkhead and move to your right about 20 feet. There should be a fire hydrant on the bulkhead waist high." "Got it." "Good. Now turn around and with your back to the bulkhead, slowly walk forward through the shop." Then I got the eerie feeling again that I wasn't alone. Something was near. I felt the body floating above me. Soon the overhead was filled with floating forms. Obviously, my movement through the water created a suction effect that drew the floating masses to me. Their skeletal fingers brushed across my copper helmet. The sound reminded me of the tinkle of oriental wind chimes. This time, I did not panic. Instead, I gently pushed the bodies clear and moved through the compartment. I shuffled through the workshop area, threading my way around lathes, milling machines, and drill presses. I stopped and again found myself surrounded by ghostly, bloated forms floating on the overhead, all without heads. This shop had been the damage control battle station for 100 of the crew. The violent explosions from bombs and torpedoes, plus the forceful impact of water, must have thrown the sailors like rag dolls against bulkheads, breaking their necks and severing skulls from spines. Voracious scavenger crabs had finished the job. It was not something I wanted to think about, and I pushed it from my mind as I moved forward again. That is when I stumbled over what felt like a torpedo, the object I had come down here to find. Topside, I found it. I'm at the nose cone. Careful, warned the voice from topside. That's where the detonator is located. I know, I'm still at the nose cone. It's wedged under a lathe. As soon as I circle this machine, I'll feel my way down the torpedo body and attach the propeller lock. Keep us posted on your progress. Once in position, I reached out for the torpedo, but there was nothing there. I'm on the other side of the lathe, but I can't feel the body of the torpedo, I reported. Silence. Then a voice said, The chief torpedo man thinks that the nose cone may have separated from the body of the torpedo after impact. I slowly worked my way to the hole in the side of the ship where the torpedo would have entered. Strangely, I still could not find the torpedo body, and I reported this to topside. No one topside seemed to have any ideas regarding the missing torpedo, so I returned to the detonator. I felt around the cone and soon determined that I had found a large caliber shell instead of a torpedo. It had metal fins welded to its base, and the nose cone was shaped much like a shell. I reported this information. The chief torpedoman thinks it's a shell, too. He thinks the Japanese welded fins on it so it would spiral like a bomb when it was dropped from a plane. The chief says it doesn't pose any danger under the lathe. Are you ready to come up? Topside asked. Take up the slack in my lines and see if they are clear. I gave the lines a hard yank. Did you feel that? I asked. Negative. Then, as if someone had thrown a switch, my air supply stopped. What's wrong with my air supply? I yelled. No answer. The topside phone key was depressed, but all I could hear was panic-stricken shouting. I quickly closed the exhaust valve in my helmet before all the air escaped from my helmet and suit. Take in my slack, I'm coming up, I yelled, fear rising in my voice. Back came a rapid reply. Your lifeline is hung up. Retrace your steps and clear it as quickly as you can. I knew the oxygen remaining in my helmet could not sustain life for more than 2 minutes. By now the air had escaped from my suit, causing the dress to press tightly against my torso, the pressure from the surrounding water flattening it. As the pressure increased, I felt the huge, roiling mass of panic surge into my throat. I tried desperately to hold back the growing anxiety within me. I had seen what terror could do to a man. It could take possession of mind and body and prevent him from helping himself, even cause him to give up completely. I told myself to concentrate on surviving. I grabbed the lifeline and started back, pulling hand over hand toward the access trunk. The 196 pounds of diving equipment on my shoulders became an incredible weight. Without buoyancy in my suit, it became a heavy burden dragging me down. Stumbling wildly now, I bumped into milling machines and fell into drill presses, my breath quick and shallow from fear and exertion. Blind terror could destroy me. I fought it as best as I could. I finally felt where a loop in my air hose was caught on the hand wheel of a lathe. I cleared my lines and yelled, Take up my slack. Almost immediately, I felt the answering strain on the lines as my diving tenders heaved them in. It's free, someone shouted over the phone. Stay calm. We'll have you up in a minute. I did not have breath enough to answer. Without air pressure in my suit, foul, fetid water poured in through my suit cuffs and the exhaust valve in my helmet. I could feel the coolness of it around my neck. I felt the constant frantic pull on my lines as my tenders heaved me in. I stumbled and fell as they pulled me over and around a milling machine. Filthy water gushed into my mouth. Somehow I was able to regain my feet only to be slammed against a lathe and then pulled over the top of it in a mad, tumbling journey to the surface and fresh air. But time had run out for me. I fell again and putrid liquid rushed into my face. I stood up again, coughing and gagging. My breathing was labored, and the panic was like a rat behind my forehead, twisting and gnawing. I was not aware that my instinct to survive had vanished. Bursts of stars and brilliant white shards of light exploded before my eyes. A loud ringing filled my ears. Even in my dire state, I recognized the symptoms of carbon dioxide toxicity and oxygen deficiency. 100 ugly visions flashed through my mind, grim reminders that I was going to die down here among these headless corpses. The strain on my lifeline was from above my head now, holding me upright. A red haze passed before my eyes, grew fainter and fainter and finally disappeared into blackness. I was dying, and the part of me that still cared knew it. But for now, I would just close my eyes and go to sleep. Chapter 1. San Diego, California. Training for War. Hey, Ed, let's volunteer for diving school. This suggestion came from my best buddy in the Navy, Robert Moon Mullen. He was reading a repair unit directive when an announcement caught his eye. It requested volunteers for a one-month second-class diving course commencing 1 May 1941 aboard the USS Ortolan, tied up at the foot of Broadway Pier in San Diego Harbor. Mullen was a Boston shanty Irishman, fun-loving and full of blarney. 6 feet tall, he weighed in at 185 pounds. Moon had straight black hair, parted in the middle, and ears that stuck out of his head like two open car doors. His nickname, Moon, came from a vintage cartoon character. "Sure, Moon, why not?" I said. "It doesn't look as if I'm ever going to be a pilot. Might as well learn to work under the water instead of flying over the top of it." I smiled ruefully as I thought about the disappointments I had experienced trying to become an aviator. Despite that, I liked Navy life. It had trained me in welding and ship fitting, and had given me rapid advancement to metalsmith first class. Best of all, it had given me a chance to apply my leadership abilities. But despite all the benefits, I would have given it up in a second for a chance to become a flyer. I never thought of myself as a 20-year man. I planned to stay in the Navy for my 4-year enlistment and then see if the economy had improved enough to get out and find a decent job. College did not appeal to me because far too many college graduates from my hometown of Riverside, California, were pumping gas in service stations. It was the Navy's recruitment pitch that caught my attention and fired my imagination. In May 1939, visions of adventure and travel appealed to my young, restless spirit. I enlisted, toughed out 3 months of boot training, then was assigned to the repair ship USS Vestal, swinging around her buoy in San Pedro. To my dismay, she got underway only once every quarter for an overnight cruise. Some of the old hands aboard her swore the purpose of the trip was to prevent the ship from going aground on the mountain of coffee grounds beneath her. In 1940, the Vestal sailed with the fleet to Hawaii, where it remained to provide repair services to the battleships. During 2 years on the Vestal, I learned shipfitting, welding, and burning skills. In May 1941, I was transferred to the Destroyer Repair Unit 1, which was formed at the destroyer base in San Diego. Mullen handed me the directive regarding the diving course as we hurried over to the administrative office. We requested diving school, and we both were accepted. Diving school on the Ortolan, a submarine rescue vessel, proved to be exciting and challenging to me and the other 8 men in the class. We learned how to handle ourselves underwater, to ascend, descend, and move through thick mud. We learned to use an underwater gas-cutting torch, a stud driver to fasten steel plates together, and how to dig trenches in the mud using a washout nozzle. After we returned to the destroyer repair unit, we resumed our regular duties repairing the ships assigned for overhaul work. Mullen and I had previously discussed building a small diver's training tank on the pier to practice our underwater cutting and welding skills. We approached our division officer with the idea, and he gave us the okay, provided we built the tank with scrap metal and did the work on our own time. We built the tank, and it was in service within 30 days. None of us second-class divers could be considered experienced, since our training had been minimal and we had little or no practical experience. Our biggest achievements were our newfound abilities to burn and weld underwater. War. On the morning of 7 December 1941, Moon and I and some of our buddies won our division softball tournament. We joined the losing team for soft drinks at the base gedunk stand, or soda fountain, after the game. The radio in the corner was blaring out swing tunes when suddenly an announcer interrupted the program with a special bulletin: Pearl Harbor was bombed by the Japanese at 8 a.m. today, Hawaiian time. Everyone was incredulous over the news. We shook our heads and muttered doubts that this could happen to our Navy. My disbelief turned to white-hot anger as the reality of the attack registered in my mind. America is at war. A feeling of excitement welled up in me. By God, we'll kick their butts, I thought. I couldn't wait to get at the enemy. I had no idea of the horror I was so eager to encounter. The repair department sent word to all of the divers to report to the office at 1200 hours. I hurried over to the barracks to clean up and then report for duty. After showering, I stepped out of the stall and wrapped a towel around my waist. I glanced approvingly in the mirror at the well-developed muscles in my arms and shoulders that tightened and relaxed as I vigorously lathered my even-featured face. I had always been strong and in good shape. Football and baseball helped in school, and the Navy strengthened and filled out my muscular body even more. I finished shaving, patted on some lotion, straightened to my height of 6 feet, and ran a comb through my dark brown hair. I changed into my working uniform and reported to my division officer, Lieutenant George Dawns, in the repair office. After all the divers were assembled, Dawns told us that something big was in the wind for us and that he would have more information on the matter after the all-officers meeting scheduled for 1300. At 1400, Lieutenant Dawns again herded us into his office and closed the door. "Men," he began, "you have 2 hours to get packed and be in front of your barracks. A bus will pick you up at 1630 and transport you to Naval Air Station Coronado. You will be making a long flight tonight. I am not at liberty to tell you where you are going or how long you will be gone, or even if you will return to San Diego. You are directed not to make any telephone calls to your families or to girlfriends before you leave. You can send them a postcard when you arrive at your final destination. As the senior petty officer, Raymer will be carrying your service records, sealed orders, and pay records with him. Good luck to you. Get moving. You don't have much time." We filed out of his office and hurried over to the barracks. Moon occupied the bunk and locker next to mine. As we packed our sea bags and ditty bags, we speculated on the secret mission. We both agreed, from all the evidence, that our destination must be Pearl Harbor. We were naively unaware of the number of ships sunk or damaged. The president had described only minimal damage in his brief statement regarding the attack, except for the sunken battleship Arizona. The Navy bus picked us up promptly and made the short trip across San Diego Bay by ferry. The bus dropped us off at the seaplane ramp in the air station at 1700. We trooped aboard the waiting PB-2Y aircraft with our personal belongings. Already on board were 4 Army colonels, 3 Navy captains, and several civilians. We 9 divers were the only enlisted men aboard. The plane taxied out into the bay and took off immediately as we settled down on the floor, using our sea bags for headrests. The pilot informed us that our cruising speed would be 150 knots, and we should arrive at our destination in approximately 14 hours. The noise and vibration from the plane's engines were deafening. It was impossible to speak above them or to be heard. We divers had to be content to sleep, read, or be silent with our thoughts. I looked across at the men with whom I had spent the last few months learning the intricacies of underwater diving techniques. These were the men I would depend on for my life in the days to come. There was Moon, snoozing on his back, his long arms folded neatly on his chest. Next to him, Tony Salvatore, a tall, very dark, good-looking Italian. A mystery to us all. He had never revealed much about himself, past or present. Sitting up, with pencil and paper perched on his bent knees, was Andy Davis, the unsophisticated boy from Iowa, writing yet another letter to his Enid, the only girl he had ever loved. Bill Rush was next in line. Bill was from Oklahoma and bragged incessantly about his 2 big accomplishments, breaking horses and breaking the hearts of babes. None of us believed the stories of his latter accomplishments, so we settled on the nickname Bronco Bill for him. Despite all his bluster, Bronco turned out to be an excellent diver and an asset to our diving crew. Sleeping noisily next to him was Ben Apple, an inappropriate name for this burly 250-pound horse of a man. Coarse and foul-mouthed, but a tireless worker, Ben had the strength of a giant. By contrast, Jimmy Wilson, with his dark curly hair and innocent face, looked almost childlike as he lay sleeping on his side. Martin Palmer sat next to him, quiet, bookish, squinting over a copy of Time magazine. And lastly, Cameron Walker, the wiry, talkative Texan, nervous and twitching even in sleep. Their ages ranged from 21 to 26, and all were intelligent and able. These men wanted that greater degree of adventure associated with diving, and now they were headed for an unknown, dangerous mission. Good men, I thought, every one of them. Hours later, I was able to sleep fitfully as the plane's engines droned on, carrying us ever closer to the islands. All at once, the plane encountered rough weather, and its shuddering and bouncing awakened me. I glanced at my watch, 2300. I tried to sleep again, but too many thoughts crowded my mind. I closed my eyes and thought of my hometown. What a great place to grow up. What good times to remember at old Poly High and Laurie. Oh, yes, Laurie Hampton. I could see her in my mind's eye, her face framed with her honey blonde hair. Laurie was my high school sweetheart, my unforgettable first love. I hadn't seen her since before my enlistment, and by this time she was probably married with two kids. I wondered what she thought about my enlisting in the Navy. Did she hold me in the same low regard that so much of society held for the American sailor? Perhaps she had heard the comment President Roosevelt's wife Eleanor had made about sailors, the cleanest bodies and the dirtiest minds in the world. The hell with Eleanor, I thought. How many sailors does she know? How can she judge the whole Navy? Eleanor was not the only one who held sailors in low esteem. I had heard that the city of Norfolk, Virginia, erected signs in their parks that read, "Sailors and dogs keep off the grass." I recognized that the Navy had a few bad apples, but the vast majority of sailors were dedicated fighting men. I recalled a favorite poem of mine by Rudyard Kipling that compared the public's attitude toward the British soldier serving in peacetime and wartime roles. I smiled ruefully as I thought things have changed little since Kipling's time. Maybe the country has not appreciated sailors in the past, but as Kipling predicted, the public will exalt us as heroes now that the United States is at war. A wave of homesickness and loneliness engulfed me, and I tried unsuccessfully to shake it off. I had just attained the ripe old age of 21. All the people and places I loved were far away, and I didn't know if I would ever see them again. Aftermath of the attack. We were awakened by the pilot's voice. He reported that he had just made contact with two U.S. Navy fighter aircraft that would be escorting the plane into Oahu. Our estimated time of arrival was 30 minutes away. Spotting the two airplanes out the porthole, flying gracefully alongside, caused me to mourn once more the missed opportunities and disappointments that had prevented me from becoming a pilot. I had missed joining the Army Air Corps Cadet Program by just 1 year. I almost made it on the next try, just 6 months ago. I had heard rumors the RAF and RCAF had stationed a recruiter, Captain Wright Melville, in a room at the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel. He was signing up U.S. active duty military personnel as pilots if they passed the written and physical examinations for the British Air Force. In addition, the British recognized that the American military volunteers were mature, seasoned fighting men, so they were being commissioned with ranks equivalent to U.S. Army Air Corps first lieutenants and captains. I rushed to Hollywood for an interview, then completed all the examinations and passed them easily. I was due to be discharged from the Navy on 1 July and sworn in as an officer in the RAF, but to my distress, the entire program was canceled by the federal government in late June. A very powerful group known as the America First Party, headed by Charles Lindbergh, put pressure on Congress and the President so the program was discontinued. Rightly or wrongly, the America Firsters felt the United States was becoming too involved in the European war. Ironically, I thought bitterly, my boyhood hero, the famous Charles Lindbergh, played a large part in denying me a chance to become an aviator. The seaplane captain was again on the speaker, reporting that the landing site had been changed from Ford Island in Pearl Harbor to Kaneohe NAS on the windward side of the island. He said there were a lot of nervous gunners in and around Pearl Harbor, and 4 or 5 carrier aircraft from the USS Enterprise had been shot down the previous evening. He also noted that armed sentries were shooting first and asking questions later during the night patrols. The pilot advised us that dawn would be breaking soon and we would make a flyby of Pearl Harbor, keeping out of gunnery range on our way around the island to Kaneohe Bay. The sun was just coming up out of the ocean when Oahu came into view. I was numbed by shock and disbelief at the panorama of wholesale destruction below. The airfields of Wheeler, Hickam, and Ford Island had been burned out. Damaged planes were tossed about like abandoned toys on their runways. Pearl Harbor was a disaster. Although the ships could not be identified, it looked as if there were at least 20 either damaged or sunk, and most of these appeared to be the pride of the Navy, the battleships. 100 questions raced through my mind as I stared at the scene below. How could this have happened? How could our huge armor-plated battleships be sunk by foreign airplanes? With so much of the fleet out of commission, how would the Navy protect America? Why didn't Japan land its troops and capture Hawaii after such a successful raid? Why did President Roosevelt report only minor damage sustained from the attack? Huge billowing clouds of black smoke engulfed 3 of the battleships. Orange tongues of flame leapt up through the black vortex. Wrecked ships were strewn about within the dry docks. Other ships showed signs of great damage, with weird outcroppings of twisted metal that changed their silhouettes beyond recognition. But it was the sea of heavy bunker oil in which all the ships were floating that brought down a curtain of finality to the scene. The viscous oil thickly layered everything in the harbor. The hulls of ships and the pilings on docks were coated with it, and the entire shoreline was blackened. Nothing escaped the oil's ravages. Early rays of the morning sun created an unreal reflection on the surface of the oil that mirrored the grotesque shapes of the broken ships. I stared in horror at America's terrible loss. There was no longer any doubt in my mind about our final destination or what our job would be. Arrival in Pearl Harbor. After our plane landed in Kaneohe NAS, we were picked up by a Navy bus and transported across the island to the receiving station at Pearl Harbor. We were issued lockers and bunks in the last barrack in the row of buildings. We were the only occupants. The officer of the deck directed us to report to the salvage unit, which was newly formed at the Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard. Warrant Officer Albert Calhoun was the designated officer in charge. He looked tired and harassed. He informed us that he had not closed his eyes in 24 hours. I delivered our records to Calhoun and inquired about our diving assignments. The bosun ordered us to take a truck and pick up 4 sets of deep-sea diving gear from the submarine base. When we returned with the diving outfits, he sent us to 1010 dock, where we selected a suitable sampan from the dozen that were tied up. The sampans had been owned by alien Japanese fishermen and were confiscated months before by the U.S. government because aliens were not permitted to own boats in Hawaii. We selected a 70-foot craft, installed a diving air compressor, and outfitted it with 2 complete sets of deep-sea diving gear. After spending 3 hours equipping the boat, we reported back to Mr. Calhoun. We took seats in the room adjoining Calhoun's office. I gazed out the large windows lining the room, aghast at the morbid scene of destruction in the harbor. I looked toward the northern end of 1010 dock, and the first thing that caught my eye were the masts of the capsized mine layer Oglala draped over the dock. Farther down the dock were 2 of our newer light cruisers, Honolulu and Helena, their crews fighting to save them from sinking. Turning to the unbelievable scene in the harbor was gut-wrenching in its sadness. Huge oil fires burned out of control on the surface of the waters, fed from ruptured fuel tanks on the Arizona. Fires were still being fought aboard the battleships West Virginia, Tennessee, and California. It appeared that the fires that had burned so fiercely on Ford Island had been extinguished. The huge pall of black smoke that hung over the battleships obscured parts of the island, but clearly visible were the tangled remains of the dozens of wrecked and burned-out airplanes scattered about. My gaze shifted to the southern area of the harbor where the naval shipyard was located. The first casualty that met my eyes was the destroyer Shaw. She was in floating dry dock number 2, which had been sunk by bombs. The Shaw lay crazily on her side, and most of her bow was blown away by the force of heavy explosions. She appeared to be a total loss. From my vantage point, I could look down on one of the most sickening sights of all in this devastating scene. The number 1 dry dock was at the head of 1010 dock. The battleship Pennsylvania and destroyers Cassin and Downs were dry docked at the time of the attack. The battleship had been hit with a small bomb. The 2 destroyers were bombed and caught fire, and all hell broke loose when the fires ignited shells, depth charges, and torpedoes, which then ripped the destroyers apart. The dry dock was purposely flooded to help extinguish the flames. The flooding caused the Cassin to topple over on the downs, which helped create visually an even worse disaster than really existed. I was sure that the Pennsylvania must also be heavily damaged. We later learned that both destroyers were total losses, but the battleship suffered only light damage. It was repaired and fully operational by 20 December 1941. Before I start on the list of damaged and sunken ships, I need to find out a little more about each of you, said Calhoun. Right now, all I have is a list of names and a pile of service records. My boss, Lieutenant Haynes, whom you will meet later, will want to know about your Navy background, what your specialties are, qualifications, etc. So just hit the high points and keep it brief. He glanced down at the sheaf of papers. Raymer, let's start with you and work clockwise around the room. Raymer, metalsmith first class. Much of my experience has been welding, and I am a qualified pressure hull welder. I served aboard the Vestal. I have practiced underwater arc welding and cutting with a gas torch. Following my remarks, the rest of the divers indicated their repair specialties and work experiences. Welcome aboard the salvage unit, Calhoun said. You'll be attached to this command on temporary additional duty, which may not be so temporary, judging from the amount of diving work you see before you. The bosun read us a directive from the Commander-in-Chief Pacific that ordered all repair facilities to get the least damaged ships back in fighting condition first. He also told us that our primary work would involve raising the sunken battleships, since few of the ships afloat suffered underwater damage. To the best of my knowledge, no one had ever raised a battle-damaged battleship before. No salvage histories or guidelines were available to educate us. Our perceptions of what was involved in raising such a ship were very restricted. From a practical and logical viewpoint, I opined, the exterior holes in the hulls must be made watertight first. Then the interior of the ship would be emptied of water by pumping or being blown dry with compressed air. But I had no idea how all this would be accomplished or how long it would take. Bosun Calhoun then launched into an account of the attack the day before and reviewed the damage suffered by the sunken battleships. He said the USS Nevada was berthed astern of the Arizona when she was struck by a torpedo in her bow. She managed to get underway with her guns blazing, the only battleship able to do so. As she rounded the southern tip of Ford Island, she was smashed with an avalanche of bombs, which started intense fires. When the thick, pungent smoke from the fires poured into the machinery spaces, the Black Gang, or engineers, headed for topside and fresh air. This forced abandonment left the pumping machinery inoperative. The forward ammunition magazines were purposely flooded to prevent explosions from the fires, but the after magazines were also flooded by mistake, which caused the ship to sink lower and lower in the water. In addition, ballast tanks were flooded on the starboard side to correct a port list. As more water entered the ship, many fittings that passed through watertight bulkheads began to leak, flooding all machinery spaces and causing loss of all electrical and mechanical power. Nevada was sinking in the ship channel. Admiral William R. Furlong, senior officer afloat, ordered tugs to take her in tow and beach her before she sank and bottled up the only entrance and exit to Pearl Harbor. She was grounded with her stern near the shore and her bow in deep water. The Nevada's wounds alone were not serious enough to sink her. Rather, it was the loss of her watertight integrity combined with progressive flooding that doomed her. The bosun yawned, rubbed his bloodshot eyes, and continued as we all listened in silent fascination and disbelief. He told us the former battleship Utah had been converted to a practice bombing target. Her anti-aircraft guns and decks were covered with shields to protect them from non-explosive practice bombs. He guessed that enemy planes probably mistook her for an aircraft carrier, since one was often berthed in that space. Two torpedo hits sent the unprotected ship to the harbor floor, bottom side up. The bosun said he doubted the Navy would raise the Utah because it had little military value. In addition, he indicated a similar fate awaited the USS Arizona, since most of the eyewitness accounts of her sinking reported that her entire bow leapt out of the water from the force of a tremendous explosion in the forward section. These accounts indicated that she was broken in two pieces and probably was not worth salvaging. The Arizona sank right side up within 9 minutes. He said it was feared that more than 1,000 men died aboard her. Fires fueled by her ruptured tanks were still raging out of control and were threatening to destroy other ships in the path of the flames. One of the threatened ships was the USS California. She was hit by two torpedoes and one bomb. Numerous other bombs exploded alongside. One near miss at the bow tore a 15-foot hole in the hull and opened leaks in the gasoline storage tank and lines. After she was torpedoed, the ship listed 16 degrees to port. To compensate for the list, two fire rooms and the starboard torpedo blister were purposely flooded. As she settled lower in the water, progressive floating started throughout the ship from open manholes, ventilation systems, pipelines, and the inadequate setting of battle-ready closure conditions. A combination of water and oil flooded the machinery spaces, rendering pumps and other machinery inoperative. These vital pumps were needed to fight fires and dewater compartments. The bosun's voice took on an almost defeated tone as he told us that at 1000 hours yesterday, raging fires swept down on California, engulfing her in flames. The order was given to abandon ship because the crew had no means of fighting the fires. This abandon permitted uncontrolled flooding to continue throughout the ship. He said it was very unlikely that the crew could prevent her from sinking since they lacked the pumps to dewater the compartments. Next on his list of casualties was the USS West Virginia. She was hit by three aerial torpedoes on her port side. She keeled over, listing 25 degrees. Four more torpedoes struck her. Fearful that she would capsize, the senior officer aboard ordered the starboard torpedo blister counter-flooded. At this point, West Virginia became impaled on USS Tennessee's bilge keel, preventing her from capsizing. Electric power was dead, pumps were inoperable, and a huge oil fire burned below decks. A wall of burning fuel oil from the stricken Arizona surrounded the ships. Without the means to fight the fires, the order was given to abandon ship. The last ship on the bosun's list was the Oklahoma. He said she was struck amidships on her port side by seven torpedoes. A gash 200 feet long was opened in her hull, and she took a 30-degree list to port. Bursting her mooring lines to the USS Maryland, inboard of her, she rolled over upside down. 400 men were trapped inside, and maximum efforts were currently underway to rescue them. I looked out the window and saw 200 feet of Oklahoma's starboard bottom above water. Diving assignments. The bosun gave us our assignments for the afternoon. We were to proceed to the upside-down Oklahoma and report to Commander Kenworthy. If he had no diving work for us, we would then proceed to the Nevada and report to Lieutenant Commander Thomas. We climbed into the sampan and headed out through the dead sea of bunker oil strewn with flotsam and wreckage. Bill Rush inched the sampan through the debris until we reached the Oklahoma. As we pulled alongside, I wondered out loud if it was possible that anyone was still alive in the hulk. There was tremendous activity around the Oklahoma. Floodlights were set up and the bottom hull was crawling with sailors and shipyard workmen. The sound of pneumatic hammers reverberated against the steel bottom plates, beating out a cadence that could be heard around the harbor. It sent a message of hope to the men trapped below, assuring them that help was on the way. Mullen asked one of the workers why they were chiseling out holes in the bottom when a cutting torch would be so much faster. The worker replied that they had tried that yesterday and the toxic fumes from the burning paint and cork had killed two trapped men. Now the only safe way to rescue the men was to chisel holes in the bottom hull. We also learned that eight men were rescued just 30 minutes before we arrived and had been sent to the hospital for observation after their terrifying experience. All told, 31 sailors were released from their underwater tomb before rescue efforts were abandoned. I later read a statement from Machinist Mate Second Class W.F. Staff, a survivor of the capsized USS Oklahoma. Staff was one of the last men rescued at 2 a.m. Tuesday, 9 December 1941. His statement testifies to the mounting terror the survivors experienced. Sunday morning at 07:50 on 7 December 1941, I was in the carpenter shop when the general alarm was sounded. I immediately went along the starboard side of the third deck to my battle station. I felt several explosions on the way to repair two. When I got to repair two, I took my phones and went to get a flashlight, but they were locked up, so I went on down to A28, the forward air compressor room, and started to set Zed. There was an electrician's mate and fireman also, centers, JP, machinist's mate second class, and myself in the compartment. When the lights went out, the fireman and electrician's mate started to go out the Zed hatch, which had been set by repair too. They were yelling and screaming. Water and fuel oil were coming down the hatch. I tried to stop them from opening the hatch, but couldn't. The next thing we knew, we were all under water and oil. Centers and myself were the only ones that came up. It took us some time in the dark to find out that we were back in A-28 and the ship had capsized. We then tried to get into the linen storeroom. It was on the starboard side and was out of the water. A-28 was about half full of oil and water. The storeroom was locked and it took several hours to beat the lock off with a wrench that we found on the air compressor. We could not get into the storeroom as gear must have wedged against the door. We tried to get into a small storeroom which was on the overhead, but it was also locked and we could not get into position to beat the lock off. About Monday noon we heard tapping and we answered them. After so long, they were right overhead and we could hear them talking. When they started to cut into us, it let out air and we were under air pressure. The water came up as our air escaped. The water came up and ran out the hole they were cutting and they left, but we still had about 6 inches of airspace. We tried the linen room again, and it gave a little. Apparently, the water had cleared the gear from the door, and we went in and started tapping again. The rescuers soon got out to us again, and we left the ship at 0200 Tuesday morning. I wish to thank these men for their hard work in rescuing us. Keenum, chief bosun's mate, Thomas, shipfitter first class, and Harris, carpenter's mate second class. Commander Kenworthy did not need us on the Oklahoma, so we proceeded to the Nevada. The senior officer aboard, Lieutenant Commander Thomas, directed us to sound the sunken hull at 30-foot intervals. To accomplish this, we lowered a diver from the sampan to a depth of 20 feet. Swinging a 5-pound hammer, he rapped on the hull 3 times, then stopped and listened for an answering signal. We took turns for 5 hours. No answering signal was ever heard. We learned later that all the men killed or injured on the Nevada were either blown overboard or were carried from below decks by crew members on the day of the attack. Tired and filthy after our disappointing mission, we piled into the sampan and headed for 1010 dock. Rescue attempts. Early on 9 December, we assembled on the sampan, eager to start salvage work on the Nevada. Before we could cast off the lines, I spotted Bosun Calhoun hurrying down the dock waving to us. With him was a stranger wearing the insignia of a lieutenant. This must be the diving officer, I thought to myself. The bosun arrived slightly out of breath from his sprint down the dock. "Men, this is Lieutenant H.E. Haynes." Haynes was a small, wiry man, 50-ish, balding, with a florid complexion that escalated to bright red whenever he became angry or flustered. He was a Mustang, meaning an officer who had come up through the enlisted ranks and attained officer's status. "Thank you, Mr. Calhoun. I want to talk to the divers alone," he said brusquely, dismissing his assistant. I eyed our new boss with some apprehension as he climbed down the Jacob's ladder to the float and stepped aboard the sampan. "Good morning, sir. Raymer, metalsmith first class," I saluted briskly. "Yes, Raymer," he said, returning my salute. "I've seen your service record as well as the records of the other divers. I am pleased to have you all aboard as members of my diving team." We shuffled about and mumbled acknowledgments in unison, unaccustomed to such a personalized greeting from an officer. The crusty old diving officer cautioned us about some of the hazards we could expect to encounter on the ships, but he was careful to point out that no one could identify all the dangers because few, if any, divers had experienced diving inside a battle-damaged ship strewn with wreckage. He emphasized that because of the floating oil, sediment, and debris in the water, underwater lights would be useless. Diving inside the ships would be done in complete and utter darkness. This would require us to develop a keen sense of feel, great manual dexterity with tools, and a high degree of hand-to-brain coordination. Since the Navy had no safety precautions for such a situation, we would be required to devise our own. Lieutenant Hayes motioned for me to step out on the float so we could speak privately. He explained that the diving crew would rarely have a diving officer attached, and even then he would not be experienced in salvage work. He lit his pipe and puffed a few times until the tobacco glowed. He told me that, over his objections, the senior salvage officer had assigned the exterior hull work to the Pacific Bridge and Shipyard civilian divers. Interior work on the ships was to be the responsibility of the Navy divers because they were familiar with the insides of battleships. I told him that, to my knowledge, none of us had served aboard a battleship, but that this fact should not create too many problems salvaging the ships. I was expressing more confidence than I felt. While it was true that none of us served aboard battleships, Mullen and I were attached to repair ships before the war, and we had performed repair work aboard some battleships. While serving aboard the Vestal as a welder, I spent some time aboard battleships increasing their battle condition. We cut out portholes in their hulls at the second and third deck levels and welded in metal blanks to replace them. This experience was no substitute for the knowledge of the ships I would have gained as a member of the crew. Lieutenant Haynes then gave us our diving assignments: dynamite the concrete quays that pinned the Tennessee against the West Virginia and sound the hulls of the sunken ships to ensure that no one was trapped within them. He indicated that the rescue of any possible survivors took precedence over every other operation. Haynes also pointed out that since we would not be diving deeper than 45 feet within the ships, we could stay down all day and not concern ourselves about suffering from the bends or other diving illnesses. He neglected to discuss the possibility of performing our necessary bodily functions after hours underwater, but we soon learned how to cope with that. Our diving team did not attend morning quarters because our new bosses in the salvage unit didn't operate under a structured type of organization. Most of the time, we received our orders directly from the diving officer. At other times, when an officer was assigned to a special project, we were directed by the diving officer to take orders from him. I assigned Mullen, Rush, Wilson, Palmer, and Salvatore to the job of sounding the hulls, while the rest of the men and I worked on freeing the Tennessee. Mullen and his team started sounding the hull of the Utah, since it was possible there were some crew members who might have escaped into the double bottoms, as some men did on the Oklahoma. But before Moon and his divers could start sounding the hull, the last man to survive the upside-down battleship Utah was rescued by crew members from the Utah and the Raleigh. His name was John Veason, Fireman Second Class. He courageously remained at his post on the electrical distribution board until it was too late to get off the overturning ship. His act of courage kept the lights burning and allowed many of his shipmates to find their way off the ship, which they may not have been able to do in the dark. He hammered incessantly on the inside of the hull with a wrench for two terrifying days. Trapped in the black interior of the ship, he was weakened by lack of water, food, and sleep, and sick with the heat, which reached 150 degrees. Desperate with thoughts of death, his waning tapping was finally heard by shipmates on Ford Island. A volunteer crew returned with a cutting torch, burned a hole in the bottom, and finally released Veason. Tragically, Veason died soon after from unknown causes. Mullen used a careful and thorough search technique designed to locate any survivors on the remaining sunken ships. Beginning at the bow of the ship, the diver was lowered 20 feet under the water. At that point, he hammered on the hull 3 times with a 5-pound hammer. He then listened for a response. If there was none, he was moved in intervals of 25 feet, and the procedure repeated until he finally reached the stern. Upon reaching the stern, the diver was lowered an additional 25 feet to the mud line, at which time he repeated the same sounding procedure until he reached the bow. Then the opposite side of the ship was covered in the same fashion. Generally, the starboard sides of the ships were sounded first, since they suffered the least damage from bombs and torpedoes. We reasoned that if there were any survivors, they would most likely be alive on the undamaged side. We also felt that the underwater sounds of our hammering would penetrate the ship's hulls more effectively through an intact starboard hull. Moon and his team were able to sound one battleship during each 14-hour day. When they returned at night, they were exhausted from the grueling schedule. Moon said it was the only time that the tenders had to work harder than the diver. Holding a diver suspended at 20 feet for 3 hours at a time strained the muscles of even the strongest among us. We all worked together on the last 2 ships to give them some relief. The last ship sounded was the West Virginia. We worked the port side first because the starboard side was partially blocked. The port side hull suffered a gasping torpedo wound 300 feet long. When Moon moved to the starboard side, they were unable to sound 200 feet of her hull amidships because the West Virginia was pressed tightly against the side of the Tennessee. This unfortunate situation would later return to haunt us. Meanwhile, my crew finished drilling holes in the concrete quay, set the dynamite, covered the blast area with sandbags, and detonated the charges. The Tennessee was freed, and tugs moved her over to the shipyard. She incurred only minor damage to her hull from the dynamite charges. We were disappointed that we had not been able to find any survivors on the sunken ships, but after 6 days of sounding, we were sure no one was alive within them. While our diving crews were occupied sounding the ships and freeing the U.S.